The political fallout of last night's Dáil debate on Minister Simon Coveney is all over the broadsheet front pages this morning. Coalition turmoil amid leak claims and TD's resignation is the lead headline for the Irish Independent, above Philip Ryan's account of events last night, which he writes have plunged the coalition into chaos amid accusations made under Dáil privilege by Sinn Féin that Higher Education Minister Simon Harris leaked details of Catherine Zappone's appointment. This has been denied by Minister Harris. There's, of course, lots of analysis of the goings-on. In his assessment of the debate, Pat Leahy writes on page 5 of the Irish Times that Sinn Féin gave the coalition a good kicking. He describes how the facts of the saga received scant attention, being of little use to both sides. But that's not what Wednesday night was about, he says. It was about, after a period in which political division was minimised because of COVID, redrawing the dividing lines of politics. 14 years to resolve patient waiting lists is the stark headline over the Irish Examiner's lead story this morning. Niamh Griffin writes that in its pre-budget submission, the Irish Hospital Consultants Association warned that without urgent action, it will take this length of time to get waiting lists under control. The number of people on waiting lists is now in excess of 907,000. The IHCA blames it on a combination of years of underinvestment, the pandemic and the cyber attack. Catholics set to run for UUP in election is the headline over Suzanne Breen's front page story for the Belfast Telegraph. He's 33-year-old Stephen McCarthy. He runs UUP leader Doug Beattie's office in Belfast and he'll stand in the South Belfast constituency next May. We're told that Stephen McCarthy grew up in a nationalist household and his grandfather, Mickey Lenehan, was murdered by loyalist paramilitaries in 1991. His family believes there was security force collusion. Acknowledging that he doesn't fit a simple stereotype, Stephen said he believed his story reflects the diversity that makes South Belfast tick. The Irish Sun leads on the story that pandemic-weary revellers could soon be partying until 6 a.m. under plans to shake up Ireland's nightlife, quoting Minister Catherine Martin, who said the opportunity should be there for extended hours in clubs. Saturday Night Fever is the headline, alongside a picture of the minister's face superimposed on an image from the iconic disco movie. Also on that front page, a picture of Ronaldo flags coverage of the inside story on page 13 that loud sheep have forced the footballer to move house. And in the Irish Times foreign pages, Dennis Staunton teases out the impact of Boris Johnson's latest cabinet reshuffle. He writes that the PM is still surrounded by ministerial mediocrities. The biggest loser, we're told, was Dominic Raab, whose demotion from Foreign Secretary to Justice was amplified, if anything, by his success in persuading Johnson to name him Deputy Prime Minister. He writes, if being Vice President is, as John Nance Garner once said, not worth a bucket of warm spit, then the constitutionally empty title of Deputy Prime Minister is a public declaration of its holder's political failure.
Now, the government won the confidence vote in the Dáil last night by a comfortable 92 votes to 59. But it was a bitter debate that cost the government the loss of one TD when Mark McSharry quit Fianna Fáil and voted against the motion. So is this the end of Zappone-gate? Can the government now move on? We'll have more on that after we hear this clip from the minister at the centre of what's been the big political row this summer, Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney.
Sinn Féin tonight is not attempting to hold the government or me to account or even to establish truth. Mary Lou MacDonald is not trying to get answers in this debate or achieve anything positive as regards what really happened here and how we can improve things for the future. This is a political tactic to try and extend a political controversy and to reinforce a false narrative of cronyism to damage relations in this government. Sinn Féin are doing what they do so often, north and south, stoking tension with an exaggerated narrative in an effort to create anger, resentment and division, not just in this House or in government, but across society more generally.
Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney speaking in that confidence motion debate last night. Our political correspondent Paul Cunningham is with us. That question that Simon Coveney asked there, are relations damaged in this government as a result of this vote which the government won?
I'd say you could probably put it this way, bruised. I mean, this has been a difficult few days, if not few weeks, And it's also going to have some long-term damage for Fianna Fáil. They've lost a TD, the Sligo Leitrim, South Donegal, North Roscommon TD, Mark McSharry, has gone overboard and has left. And the number of TDs that they can call on now has gone from 37 to 36. They're on the same number as Sinn Féin. It's also damaging for the coalition government insofar as they've gone down. The gap between the government and the opposition has narrowed to 82 to 77. There's been miles of newspaper coverage about the difficulties within government. We've had weeks of apologies from senior ministers. And if you put all that together, that has been disruptive, and it's also got damage that's going to linger.
There was also an allegation during the debate. We'll play the clip now before we talk about it. And this was from the Sinn Féin TD, Matt Carthy. And it related to the original leak from Cabinet. And this was a leak from Cabinet that Catherine Zappone was being appointed as an envoy by the government. A leak which appeared before the Cabinet meeting itself had concluded. Here's what Matt Carthy said under Doyle Privilege yesterday evening.
Rather than dealing with the debacle, Fine Gael were running a sting operation to expose that Simon Harris had leaked the appointment from the Cabinet meeting. Because that is how business is done. Appointments to public bodies right up to the Supreme Court are decided not by what you know, but who you know.
A flavour of what was said by Matt Carthy from Sinn Féin in the Dáil yesterday evening. A spokesman, by the way, for Simon Harris, saying later that this was a misuse of Dáil privilege and was untrue. Will there be more questions about this, Paul?
I think it's undoubtedly true that there are going to be more questions on this. The question of who leaked from Cabinet has been ongoing since that actual Cabinet meeting. I think that the denial from Minister Harris was clear, but I don't think it's going to be the end of it. I think this is something which is going to run and run. When Matt Carthy made that comment in the Dáil, in what was a bad-tempered affair at times, and the cameras looked across at the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, who shook his head slowly but intently when those allegations were made. And as you say, Minister Harris has said it's simply untrue, but it just is indicative of a long-running chaotic crisis for the coalition government, which has ended mostly due to the significant and handsome victory that the coalition won with the help of many independent TDs, but it's going to linger.
In a way, this was, of course, back to Leinster House, the start of the new Dáil term, the return to something of politics as normal. And Sinn Féin setting the tone for a term ahead, Paul, of no holds barred opposition while the government just has to sort out the budget, health and housing.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on it. There is an approach being taken by Sinn Féin because they had an option. They had the option not to go on a no confidence motion in Simon Coveney and leave the door open to maybe using that particular device later on over other issues. But instead, on the very first day of the Dáil's return, they were sending out a signal that they were going to go after the coalition government, and they were going to make a point of attacking someone, in political terms, attacking Simon Coveney, someone who has been a particularly strong performer for the government, that sort of authoritative, steady hand individual who is leading the country through Brexit, and they've gone after him, and it certainly has had a damaging effect on it. And I think Sinn Féin is sending out a signal not just about what they felt about this particular crisis, but also an intention about how they're going to conduct business over the coming weeks. And there are plenty of issues which are going to prove difficult for the government. You put your finger on the issue of a very, very difficult budget as we try and wind down those huge supports, those huge COVID supports. But they also have major other issues, controversial issues, things like maybe the Canadian EU trade deal known as CETA, which is still in an Oireachtas committee, but will come back to a vote. And it's something which will focus attention not on Fianna Fáil, but on the Green Party and whether all of their TDs are going to back any deal. So certainly you get a flavour of how it's going to be over the coming months.
Yes, climate as well will be one of the challenges as the government draws up its carbon budget and starts to specify that we put our money where our mouth is, I suppose, on meeting the targets that have been set. So plenty of challenges ahead. Paul Cunningham, political correspondent, thank you very much indeed.
An Irishman who was described as the world's largest facilitator of child abuse images has been sentenced to 27 years in prison by a US court. 36-year-old Eric Owen Marquez from Dublin had pleaded guilty to conspiracy to advertise child abuse images by operating an anonymous web hosting service. At the sentencing hearing in Maryland yesterday evening, the judge described the crime as truly despicable and the child abuse images as vile. Our Washington correspondent Brian Donovan was in court.
Eric Owen Marquez was led into the courtroom dressed in a wine-coloured prison jumpsuit and a black face mask. Courtroom 2B in the Federal District Court of Maryland was almost empty because of COVID restrictions. There was only a handful of people inside the room. Now, proceedings began with the prosecution outlining their case. They said the court had never seen a defendant like Marquez before and that he was in a league of his own. They repeated their belief that he was the world's largest facilitator of child abuse images and that he had created this online community of child exploitation. The prosecution said while they had no evidence that Marquez had ever touched a child, he had abused them again and again by facilitating the sharing of these images. Now, just to give you a quick bit of background here, Eric Owen Marquez, a dual citizen of Ireland and the US, he was arrested in Dublin back in 2013, and what followed was years of legal battles before he was extradited to the US in 2019. Last year, in February 2020, he pleaded guilty to conspiring to advertise child abuse images by operating an anonymous web hosting service on the dark web. Prosecutors say that that hosting service contained over 8.5 million images of child exploitation. Now, in court yesterday evening, the defense said there was no dispute that these images were abhorrent and that they weren't disputing the fact that Marquez knew what he did was wrong. But they said he was always very different, even as a child. They said he was a loner, he was ostracized, he'd been bullied, and the court was told that Marquez was also on the autism spectrum. A plea deal agreed by the prosecution recommended a sentence of between 21 and 27 years, and the defense urged the judge to go with the lower end of that range. They argued for a sentence of 21 years, but Judge Theodore Chuang went with the upper end and handed out a sentence of 27 years. He described the crime as truly despicable and the child abuse images as vile. The judge said that Eric Owen Marquez was the equivalent of a drugs kingpin in a drugs case. He added that it was a good thing for the world that he would be behind bars for a very long time.
There was some discussion in court, Brian, about what happens to Eric Owen Marquez once he's released, because he's planning to return to Ireland.
That's right, Gavin. The court was told that Eric Owen Marquez plans to return to Ireland immediately after he is released. Now, as part of his plea deal, if he remained in the US, he would have to undergo post-release supervision for life, whereby he would have to turn over his computers for inspection. He'd have to make himself available for searches and visits by authorities. However, he would not be blocked from travelling to Ireland. And it was Judge Theodore Chuang who asked how or if these post-release conditions would be enforced if he is in Ireland. And prosecutors didn't really seem to know the exact answer to that question. It was Marquez's defense lawyer, Brendan Hurston, who said that his client would register as a sex offender with the Gardaí when he arrived in Ireland and that he would be supervised by the Irish authorities. The defense said that Marquez's father has already reached out to counselors in Ireland about getting treatment for his son when he returns. In his ruling, Judge Chuang ordered that after the release, Marquez would have to notify Gardaí of his intentions to travel to Ireland prior to leaving the US. He said he would also recommend to the US prison authorities that Marquez gets credit for 8 years he served in custody both in Ireland and in the US since his arrest in 2013.
What's been the reaction to his sentencing?
Well, I suppose in terms of any reaction from Eric Owen Marquez himself, he stood, he looked directly at the judge as the sentence was handed down. It was difficult to see any emotion or reaction on his face behind the mask he was wearing. But just before his sentencing, Marquez briefly addressed the court. He said he was very sorry to the victims. He said he was begging the court for mercy. He said he knew what he did was wrong, that he had learned his lesson and that he would never do anything like this again. He told the judge that he had destroyed his reputation and his family's reputation, and he asked for a second chance. Now, after that 27-year sentence was handed down, the US Justice Department issued a statement thanking other authorities for their assistance with the case, including the Gardaí. Outside the court yesterday evening, I spoke with the US Attorney for Maryland, John Lenzner, who was overseeing the prosecution.
That sentence sends a powerful message to those who are trading in child pornography or are contemplating trading in child pornography. Mr. Marquez essentially created a market for others to trade and promote child pornography. And he was creating the demand and the supply for a very dangerous and harmful trade to children throughout the world. And it was important to get a sentence that not only tells those out there that we will find you and hold you accountable for trading in child pornography, but also to the victims, to make sure they know that law enforcement here and overseas are committed to finding the criminals who exploit them, and then when we can, seeking restitution for them.
Just one final one, and it came up, the judge talking about, okay, if he goes back to Ireland at the end, will the Irish authorities, are you confident that there'll be communication between the US and the Irish to ensure that he'll be watched when he goes back to Ireland?
We've had a great relationship with law enforcement in Ireland, and I expect that will continue.
That's John Lenzner, US attorney for Maryland, with our Washington correspondent, Brian O'Donovan.
Elderly low-income farmers are being locked out of state pension schemes so that they're having to work well into their 80s because they can't actually afford to retire. This is based on a study from NUI Maynooth and Teagasc, the Farm Research and Advisory Group, one of whose authors is Dr. Michael Hayden from the School of Business at NUI Maynooth. Good morning, Dr. Hayden.
Good morning, Anya, to you and your listeners.
Very good morning to you. Now, tell us how elderly low-income farmers are losing out on pensions.
Well, myself and my co-authors, Bridget McNally from Maynooth University and Anne Kinsler from Teagasc, we examined a state pension policy for farmers using case farms, which reflect the typical makeup of many farm household arrangements in Ireland. And we found that many Irish farmers find themselves in a situation at retirement where they fail to qualify for the full state pension contributory or the state pension non-contributory, and therefore remain financially dependent on farming income in retirement.
And just to clarify this, so what you're really saying, is it, Dr. Hayden, is that a lot of low-income farmers find themselves in a kind of a catch-22. They haven't made enough PRSI payments to qualify for the contributory pension because they didn't have enough income. But on the other hand, when it comes to the non-contributory pension, because they owned land and that's an asset, they're also losing out. Is that the case?
Yes, that's correct, because you have to make 40 years contribution to qualify for the state pension and contributory. And because of the low income of many farmers, they do not always meet that threshold and have not got the qualifying contributions. But on the other hand, they have a land asset. And if they are means tested based on that, they are above the threshold of means testing, and neither do they qualify for the non-contributory pension.
Do we have any idea how many farmers might find themselves in this situation? And it has an impact, doesn't it, in terms of the transfer of land?
Well, yes, it has a huge issue for generational renewal. We need to encourage young farmers to enter the industry, but equally we need to support and have mechanisms to help older farmers exit the industry. While we didn't look at a specific number of farmers that are affected, well, there's 137,000 farmers in Ireland. We have an ageing farming population, with almost a third of them over 65, and also a third of them are considered small farms with very low income. So perhaps tens of thousands of farmers are affected by this situation.
Which would be a significant number. Now, there have been recent pension reforms in PRSI, haven't there? Have they made any difference?
Well, there are pension reform under review at the moment. The National Pension Commission is currently looking at the number of years of 40 years for contribution, but that hasn't been decided upon yet, if they're going to change that. And it's currently under review, but we still are in a very unknown situation, and it really needs to be sorted out.
And how do you think it should be sorted out for farmers? A compulsory PRSI contribution, no matter what your level of income?
Well, we argue that farmers should be given the mechanism to allow them to pay. Some farmers and farmers' wives, even, or their children who are working on the farm, if they're not in formal farm partnerships, they don't even have the ability to pay, to make PRSI contributions. So the whole area of farming does need to be looked at specifically to bring in mechanisms to allow farmers. We argue that they should pay their way, but there needs to be mechanisms put in place to allow them to do that.
All right. Thank you very much indeed. And interesting in the context of the debate that's going on about pensions. That's Dr. Michael Hayden from the School of Business at NUI Maynooth.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with a Kia eSoul. Going electric? Stop wondering and start driving. The Kia e-Soul, with a range up to 452 kilometres.
Loads of goals and a Liverpool comeback in the Champions League. Des Cahill has all the details.
Yeah, so many goals, Gavin. We'll start with that Liverpool comeback victory, a real seesaw game. They won a 3-2 in the end. They took an early lead through a known goal. Mo Salah then missed a penalty as Liverpool dominated, but Milan struck twice before half-time. Rebic and Diaz scored, so they led 2-1 at the break. Mo Salah equalised early into the second half, and then a wonderful half volley by Jordan Henderson gave Liverpool that crucial 3-2 victory. This was the post-match reaction of Henderson, who had just scored his first European goal in 7 years.
I'm sure it was good for the Newville to watch, definitely. It's been a wild Champions League with the fans back, so that was really nice. You know, I thought the atmosphere was brilliant. I think we expected that. Started the game really well, you know, on the front foot as we normally do. Scored, get the penalty. And then last 10-15 minutes of the first half, we had a spell where we were finding it difficult. They scored two goals, went in at half-time. A bit disappointed that we're trailing, but I thought the lads reacted really well. You know, come out second half, started the game again really well. Got a reward, got back in the game and found the winner. So overall, delighted. And we've got to learn from that 10-15 minute spell as well.
And you got the winner. Do you know when your last Champions League goal was?
Wasn't Ludogorets, was it?
Was it? 2014. There you go. And you stroked it in as if you did it every day.
Yeah, it was nice to get back in the score sheet. You know, I haven't got many goals. But obviously something I work on, especially when I'm playing a little bit further forward in the eight. We've got to get arriving in the box and trying to get some goals. So it was nice to get in the score sheet, yeah.
In the other game of that group, Atletico Madrid and Porto drew nil-all. In Group A, Manchester City were 6-3 winners over Leipzig. And while the six goals obviously pleased Pep Guardiola, he was frustrated with the goals they conceded, especially as their next game in the group is against Paris Saint-Germain, who have the famous strikers Messi, Neymar and Mbappe. Mind you, the French side themselves were frustrated last night. They could only manage a 1-1 draw in Belgium against Bruges. Pep Guardiola, though, was full of praise for their German opponents.
It's a team, a young team, so aggressive, physicality so strong, really, really strong. So it's a fantastic team. The way they play is, I'm part of them, a big fan, because they play, they encourage. So I think Leipzig gives to the football a good message. So it doesn't matter what happens, you can play and you can do it. But of course, the quality of the players was better today, and that's why we won.
In Group C, Ajax were 5-1 winners at Sporting Lisbon and Dortmund won 2-1 at Besiktas. And in Group D, Real Madrid scored a last-minute goal to snatch a 1-0 win at Inter Milan, while the Moldovan champions Sheriff, who've battled through four rounds of qualifying to get to the group stages, beat Shakhtar 2-0. Fulham went top of the English Championship with a 4-1 win at Birmingham, while the pressure on Nottingham Forest manager Chris Hughton has intensified as they lost 2-0 at home to Middlesbrough. In golf, former winning US Ryder Cup captain Paul Azinger has questioned Brooks Koepka's desire for the competition next week and said he thinks Koepka should give up his place in the squad for someone who would love to play if he doesn't want to. Koepka, in an in-depth interview with Golf Digest, said that he finds the Ryder Cup to be tough, hectic and a bit odd, and expressed frustration that he can't take naps during the week. One of the most controversial figures in athletics, the distance running coach Alberto Salazar, has had his 4-year suspension upheld by the Court of Arbitration for Sport. In racing, trainer Gordon Elliott had his first winner since returning from suspension when Brian Cooper rode Fancy Foundations to victory at Sligo. Davy Russell is to return to the saddle at Downpatrick tomorrow after 11 months out with a neck injury, and today's racing is at Naas. It gets underway at 1:25.
Well, Fianna Fáil TD Mark McSharry has resigned from the parliamentary party. He voted against the government last night in the confidence motion, which government won by 92 votes to 59. The Taoiseach spokesperson said that Micheál Martin regrets Mark Sharry's resignation and wishes him well. And our reporter Cillian Sherlock has been looking at what this latest departure means for Fianna Fáil.
Mark McSharry's resignation is a symptom of a wider problem in Fianna Fáil, and really not directly connected to the Coveney, the Pone affair in an immediate way.
Dr. Theresa Reedy is a political scientist in the Department of Government at University College Cork.
Mark McSharry has been one of the most vocal critics of the current leadership of Fianna Fáil. I mean, really, actually, for some time, but it certainly accelerated and been amplified since the 2020 general election. And he's one of the people who is kind of most critical of the leadership of Micheál Martin, and lays a lot of the kind of electoral problems at the door of the leadership. But it also has to be said that Mark McSherry himself doesn't really articulate a kind of a vision for Fianna Fáil recovery in any substantive way. Most of his criticism has been very much just focused on the party leader, and there hasn't been a great deal of substance to his criticism.
Mark McSherry's resignation has brought renewed attention on internal divisions inside Fianna Fáil, but Kildare North TD James Lawless remains focused on the future.
I wouldn't overly read into it. Mark has been, I suppose, heading that direction for a while, heading for the exit door. Always sorry to see a member of the parliamentary party depart. But I think he has to do what's right for him. And he has been constantly critical of, I suppose, the party and the direction of the leadership for some time. So he has voted with his feet. I suppose the rest of us can get on with being in government and get on with the job at hand. And I wish him well in his future as an independent TD.
At a local level, Sligo County Councillor for Fianna Fáil, Donal Gilroy, said he hoped the resignation won't be a huge loss for the area.
Not only has Sligo lost the only Fianna Fáil TD in Sligo, he's also the only Fianna Fáil TD that represents Leitrim, and he's the only Fianna Fáil TD that represents Roscommon, even though it was only a part of North Roscommon. So it's a big loss for the party. I hope it isn't a big loss for the area. But it had got to a stage, I suppose, where he was damned if he did and he was damned if he didn't. And he chose on this occasion that he wasn't going to toe the line anymore. And he now finds himself outside the party. Talk locally will obviously go on to what's going to happen at the next election. Will he be back in the Fianna Fáil fold, or will he stand as an independent, or what will happen? And only time will tell.
Paul McAuliffe is a Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin North West and said there is renewed support for the programme for government after the recent party thinking.
Look, I'm really disappointed that Mark has decided to resign the whip. He's a long-serving member of the party, certainly longer than I. And, he also has great ability, and I suppose it's sad to see that he was so frustrated with the party and the process that he's felt that there was no other option. But I wish him the best of luck. I suppose Mark's decision, I think, certainly clears one thing up, and that's nobody is bound by the whip system unless they want to be. And I think, the idea that we're forced into voting a certain way because the whip system just isn't true. Me and many other people in Fianna Fáil support the government because we want to see the changes that we spent 10 years saying we would do if we were ever to get back into government. People have to make that choice themselves about where they can best serve their constituents. In this case, Mark has decided to resign the whip. But I think there's a lot of people in the party, certainly after the thinking, that want to roll up our sleeves now and focus on the job of government and communicating that to the wider public.
The question now is, can Fianna Fáil move on steadily from this upset? Here's Dr. Teresa Reedy again.
I mean, I think we can expect continued difficulties in Fianna Fáil until there is some degree of resolution within Fianna Fáil. And they're quite complex in nature. So there is an internal schism, if you want, are between those who kind of support the leader and the wider leadership and the cabinet and the direction that they're taking, and those who are kind of unhappy with it on the basis of the recent electoral performance and potentially also the kind of policy direction that the government is going in and the decision to go into government with Fine Gael. But right now, neither faction seems to have kind of the upper hand. So it's a little bit unclear how it's going to play out.
And that was Dr. Teresa Reedy from UCC ending that report from Killian Sherlock.
Ruthless, say the Express and the Guardian. Boris Johnson wields axe, according to the Mail and the Times. A sweep out from the Financial Times. A brutal display of authority by a Prime Minister at the height of his powers, say the Sun. That's the reaction from newspapers in Britain this morning. To a reshuffle of government ministers by the Prime Minister there. Our London editor Sean Whelan is with us now. Winners and losers shortly. Sean. Long expected, but why these changes now?
They're getting ready for an election, Gavin, and they need to have a midterm refresh in order to present a new, fresher, more dynamic looking team to the people in the United Kingdom. People have gotten used to this government. The duds in the cabinet have been well exposed by now, and it needs a change of direction as we come out of this lockdown period, this COVID-induced torpor that the country has been in. They want to try and inject a new sense of dynamism and win the next election. That's frankly what it's all about.
So has the black belt Brexiteer Dominic Raab been demoted?
Yes, he has, no doubt about it. He's taken the fall for the debacle in Afghanistan and his own particular role in that. I mean, the extraordinary leaking by Foreign Office staff of the Foreign Secretary's non-availability at a time of crisis really put the nail in his coffin, although his halo was slipping over recent months. He wasn't seen to be making a particularly strong impression on the job. So he has had to go. He's paid the price, certainly for Afghanistan, but for other things as well.
But he's taken on the new title of Deputy Prime Minister. And his tell us about his replacement in the Foreign Office, Liz Truss.
Yeah, Liz Truss, she's been handling the trade brief up until now, announcing all sorts of trade deals. They have in reality been rollovers of agreements that Britain has already had as part of its European Union membership. So it's re-signing existing agreements more than adding on brave new Global Britain things. But she's been quite successful at presenting that as securing lots of new trade deals. She's very popular with the party grassroots. She has a working class background. She's calls herself the last Thatcherite in the cabinet. So she's very, very popular with the party base. In fact, some people were looking at a recent poll of conservative activists of who they liked and didn't like in the cabinet and noting that the people who were scoring really badly in that poll had all been axed or demoted in the reshuffles yesterday. Liz Truss was right at the very top of that list, and she gets promoted up to a big job.
Brandon Lewis remains as Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, but tell us about the other movers, including Nadine Dorries.
Yeah, she's been pushed into the culture brief. Again, she'd be extremely popular with the party base because she's seen as one of those people who engage in what's called the culture wars or the war on woke, basically having a cut at what are perceived as left-wing causes or biases. She'd be expected to put the boot into the BBC or at least discipline it in some sort of way and fight the soft issues, I guess you'd call them, that attract a lot of newspaper headlines in this country, certainly to do with statues being pulled down or removed or fighting the kind of causes that students and student activists like to espouse. In terms of culture, she's written a best-selling novel and has also appeared in a reality show, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, although she didn't have permission from the party to do it, apparently, and had a six-month suspension. But again, very popular with the Conservative Party base. And between herself and Liz Truss, they would carry on this electioneering mode in the months and indeed years ahead.
Where's Michael Gove gone?
That's the most interesting of the appointments. He's been moved to the housing brief. You've got to remember, it's not just Ireland that is having real problems with housing supply, but this country also has a big, big shortage of housing. The government are trying to get more houses built, trying to make changes to things like planning laws, but that is running them into difficulties as well, particularly in the Tory heartlands. In the south of England, they lost a recent by-election, the Liberal Democrats, and that was all on the planning issue. Basically, people in nice parts of southern England didn't want more houses being built in their neighbourhoods, turfed out their Tory MP, and all of the Tory MPs in the south are getting worried about that, and they're saying we're perhaps spending too much time concentrating on winning seats in the north of England. Don't forget about the heartlands and the base. Look after them. But we've got to build hundreds of thousands of houses as well all over the country. So Michael Gove has been given this political hot potato. He is by far the most experienced minister in the government. He goes right back to David Cameron's first government. So he's been at the top table for a very long time now. He's a very skillful operator, gets things done. And he's also in charge of the securing the union, making sure that Scotland doesn't break away from the United Kingdom, sorts out the disgruntlement in Wales, which is growing, and also is in charge of the levelling up agenda, this fairly vacuous phrase which Boris Johnson throws out as part of his electoral appeal to try and secure seats in places where the Conservatives haven't traditionally won seats. Again, he is expected to put flesh on those bones and do it pretty rapidly because they're looking at an election in perhaps 2 years' time. And I suspect they're going to try and go to the country before recently announced tax rises really start to kick in.
Sean, thank you. That's our London editor, Sean Whelan.
Family-run businesses employ nearly 1 million people in Ireland, which is twice as many as foreign direct investment and the state combined. The National Family Business Sentiment Report shows that 8 out of 10 family firms hope to hire new employees in the coming 12 months if there is a supportive political and economic environment. John McGrain is Executive Director of Family Business Network. John, many employers are finding it difficult to retain and recruit staff at the moment. Family-run firms are no different. This report, though, says that COVID supports are disincentivising people from returning to work. Is that the reason for staff shortages?
Well, good morning, Petula. This is actually really good news from the Family Business Network with advisory firm Smith & Williamson this morning. At a time when everybody wants to talk about getting on with the business of getting on, getting back to work, and the best way to get people back to work is actually through incentivising all possible measures to show people that there are jobs available, need to be taken, and the family businesses who provide most of them are ready, willing and able to hire them back. There's no doubt about it, there has been some disincentivising of the retaking of jobs through things like the pandemic unemployment payment, and happily that's beginning to move forward now. But there are other things that this report talks about as we look into planning for next year. We need to talk about tapering other supports that have helped businesses stay afloat over the past 18 months, things like the employment wage subsidy scheme. And we're going to have to have a look at tapering things like the tax warehousing and rate support schemes. But overall, this is a very optimistic outlook by Ireland's largest employers, which are family businesses in every constituency in the country.
There's a lot of focus on attracting foreign direct investment to Ireland. Should there be a similar focus on scaling up Irish family-run businesses? And are there businesses with that kind of potential?
Yes and yes. I mean, the reality is Ireland has done tremendous work to attract strategically the world's best foreign direct investment companies into Ireland. The IDA has done wonderful work. And Enterprise Ireland does wonderful work in terms of supporting the indigenous sector as well. But there's definitely space to create an even stronger focus on supporting the indigenous sector, because the reality is we may have passed peak FDI. Changes in global taxation, changes in international working from home practices, etc., mean that the faster growing sector is probably going to be our indigenous sector. And the good news is that family firms are inherently pro-growth. They buy local, they hire local, they support local and they vote local. And they're at the heart of every local movement. The people who make your porridge and the people who process your payments, like Flavins and Fexco, the McCarthy family, people like that, all around the country they're positioned. This opportunity arises now as we go into a budget to talk about maximum incentives, and the big idea here would be that we know in this country, if we paid the third highest rate in the OECD of capital gains tax rate, and we know from previous practice when we reduce the rate, we collect more money for the state. There's a magic one-off opportunity to do that now, and we recommend that the government does so.
Yes, can I focus on that a little bit more? One of the unique challenges faced by family-run businesses is succession, and you'd like to see targeted reforms to capital gains tax. Can you explain why that would help?
Yeah, so this country is a relatively young country still compared to other advanced economies, and we have many family-owned firms who are sort of stuck in a generational transformation into the second or perhaps even third generation. Capital gains tax rates being the third highest in the world inhibit firms from changing generation, because often what happens is the payment of taxes on transition to the next generation needs family firms to sell physical value-producing assets. It doesn't make sense. That wouldn't happen in a non-family-owned business. So there's an opportunity here, and we know from previous government regimes that when you reduce the rate of capital gains tax, you free up economic transactions and you create more value for communities and more value for the state.
John McGrane, Executive Director of Family Business Network, thank you for coming in this morning.
The political fallout of last night's Dáil debate on Minister Simon Coveney is all over broadsheet front pages this morning. Coalition turmoil amid leak claims and TD's resignation is the lead headline for the Irish Independent, above Philip Ryan's account of events last night, which, he writes, have plunged the coalition into chaos amid accusations made under Dáil privilege by Sinn Féin that Higher Education Minister Simon Harris leaked details of Catherine Zappone's appointment. This has been denied by Minister Harris. There is, of course, lots of analysis of the goings-on. In his assessment of the debate, Pat Leahy writes on page 5 of the Irish Times that Sinn Féin gave the coalition a good kicking. He describes how the facts of the saga received scant attention, being of little use to both sides. But that's not what Wednesday night was about, he says. It was about, after a period in which political division was minimised because of COVID, redrawing the dividing lines of politics. 14 years to resolve patient waiting lists is the stark headline over the Irish Examiner's lead story this morning. Niamh Griffin writes that in its pre-budget submission, the Irish Hospital Consultants Association warned that without urgent action, it will take this length of time to get waiting lists under control. The number of people on waiting lists is now in excess of 907,000. The IHCA blames this on a combination of years of underinvestment, the pandemic and the cyber attack. Catholics set to run for UUP in election is the headline over Suzanne Breen's front page story in the Belfast Telegraph. He's 33-year-old Stephen McCarthy. He runs UUP leader Doug Beattie's office in Belfast and he'll stand in the South Belfast constituency next May. We're told that Stephen McCarthy grew up in a nationalist household and his grandfather, Mickey Lenehan, was murdered by loyalist paramilitaries in 1991. His family believes there was security force collusion. Acknowledging that he doesn't fit a simple stereotype, Stephen said he believed his story reflects the diversity that makes South Belfast tick. The escalating costs facing the state of mica and pyrite repairs gives the Irish Times its main front page story this morning. The paper reports that the government is facing increasing rebuilding and repairing costs for homes damaged by mica and pyrite and that more councils are lining up to seek public funding for the work. The Irish Sun leads on the story that pandemic-weary revellers could soon be partying until 6 a.m. under plans to shake up Ireland's nightlife, quoting Minister Catherine Martin, who said the opportunity should be there for extended hours in clubs. And there's some top-notch punning on the front of the Irish Daily Mirror with the headline, Crack of Dawn. There's lots of images of the scaled-down ploughing championships at Rathanesca and County Leash in the papers this morning. This year, it really is all about the ploughing. And on the front of the Irish Times, we see an image of three competitors doing just that, while the Independent has a shot of Bishop Dennis Nulty blessing Eamon McKeown and his tractor with holy water. But the ploughing isn't the only true sign of the changing seasons in the papers this morning. Cathy Donaghy writes in her column in The Independent about a simple morning stroll which turned into a beautiful journey of autumnal appreciation. She describes walking the still full ditches, picking blackberries and admiring the honeysuckle drooping down like elegant ballerinas dressed in scarlet. Nature's never-ending cycle of birth, decay and rebirth is all around us, she writes. Autumn and what it brings is only one small part of that delicate dance we're invited to participate in, if we can stop a while.
Eric Owen Marquez has been sentenced to 27 years in jail in the United States after pleading guilty to conspiracy to advertise child abuse images. He ran a website that shared images of the abuse, including the rape of children, from his flat in Dublin, earning him millions of euro before he was caught with the help of Gardaí in 2013 and eventually extradited to the US 6 years later. The court there heard that the 36-year-old was the world's largest facilitator of child sex abuse imagery and will remain a risk to children no matter where he ends up after serving his lengthy jail term. He says he plans to return to Ireland when he gets out of jail. Detective Chief Superintendent Declan Daly is head of the Garda National Protective Services Bureau. Good morning and thank you for taking our call today.
Good morning, Gavin. Thank you for having me on the show.
Your reaction to this sentence?
I think it's a significant sentence which I suppose reflects the harm to children from online child sexual abuse, and I suppose it reflects the complexity and the scale of Eric Marquez's enterprise. It also highlights, I think, the consequences for persons involved in any way with the creation, distribution of child abuse imagery, which is very important because obviously there are consequences and people have a belief that borders will protect from this international crime, which it won't.
How was he caught?
Well, I suppose for the, I suppose the FBI to give a more detailed account on that. But Garda Síochána had a significant involvement in the initial stages in around the search and the arrest and the recovery of evidence, which I suppose set the foundation for yesterday's conviction. And I think there's, in anybody who's involved in child exploitation online, there's a footprint, they leave a footprint behind, and that footprint they can be identified from.
The children who were abused and that abuse shared online, have they been found and helped since?
Yes, and in this case, there's a number, significant number of children who have been identified by the FBI in relation to Eric Marquez's activities, and they have all been contacted and they get the services that are provided from Nessie for them.
Were any of them in Ireland?
No, there's no children identified in Ireland that were abused through Eric Marquez's activities.
How do you catch people who upload and share images of child abuse?
Well, as I said, everyone who you know, engages in any long like online activity needs a footprint, and we identify that footprint. I won't go through the specific details, but we identify that footprint, where they are located, and we go and target them. And we're dogged in our determination to identify those people who live in Ireland and or who operate externally and exploit children online. So we're dogged in our determination in that regard.
It was a very extensive operation, as you said, to catch Eric Owen Marquez. It was also a very extensive operation to get to the stage of sentencing him yesterday, to get him to the United States and to get him to face trial.
Yes, I think there's a very strong police cooperation around the world for child abuse offences. I suppose, and Garda Síochána, we work particularly closely with the FBI, Homeland Security, Europol, Interpol, to identify victims and to seek out those who target children. I think the investigation into these activities, as you say, was considerable. And I suppose it shows the level of police cooperation you know, that's involved in these cases. And that, the investigation, notwithstanding the length of the sentence, the police investigation should also serve as a deterrent, because I'm sure at some stage Eric Marquez was of the belief that either the Gardaí were too busy or that the US police authorities were unlikely to come after him. He was wrong in that belief, and anyone else who's involved in the exploitation of children online will also be wrong if they believe that, you know, external borders will protect them.
He'll be more than 60 when he gets out of jail, and he says he wants to come back here. Now, US officials have warned that no child in the world is safe, they say, no matter where Marquez lives, and the judges impose lifetime supervision on him. Do you know how he'll be supervised when he gets out of jail and returns here?
Yeah, the offence that he's convicted of in the United States places him as a sex offender or subject to our Sex Offenders Act in this jurisdiction. So he will be managed as a high-risk sex offender when he returns to this jurisdiction.
As far as you're concerned, is Marquez on a par with the criminals who are the abusers here?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a common misconception that you know, the people who are involved in child abuse imagery, and that it's a victimless crime, and that they're the people who are involved in it do not physically and actively abuse the child. And that's incorrect. And I think this sentence highlights that child abuse, you know, imagery is based on supply and demand. In response to the demand, a child somewhere in the world is sexually abused, and therefore all involved are culpable. So it's not a victimless crime.
Detective Chief Superintendent Declan Daly, head of the Garda National Protective Services Bureau, thank you for speaking to us today.
I'm joined in studio now by Colin Brophy, Minister of State for Overseas Development and Diaspora and Fine Gael TD. And you were one of those who contributed to the confidence debate last night. Colin Brophy, you defended Simon Coveney robustly, saying he exemplified all the things we like and admire in people in public life in this country in his decades of public service. And to see people who don't understand what public service is wanting to pull him down is a disgrace. I was just wondering, given that the vote, which the government did win comfortably, but it's cost Fianna Fáil the support of one TD, is this a more humble Fine Gael this morning?
Well, I think what we have is we have a government which is consistent in one thing, that it's focused on the real issues. It's focused on getting us out of this pandemic. It's focused on job creation. It's focused on healthcare. It's focused on housing. It's focused on climate. These are the things that on a day-to-day basis that people are contacting me and my constituency, they're contacting all our colleagues, and they're asking, what are the government doing for us?
But I can tell you, I was with Fianna Fáil up in Cavan last weekend, and I can tell you what they're saying about your party is misjudgments, miscommunications, and they're fed up having to, if you like, go out and troop through the Dáil in support of your party. It's lost them a TD. Would you at least say sorry to Fianna Fáil this morning?
Well, I think, I think the motion of no confidence is one thing, but I think the deputy that left Fianna Fáil yesterday, I think that was probably no surprise to most people. He's been very vocal and very clear in his views on a lot of things.
It's still a number. Omni shambles, divvy up. These were the words that your Fianna Fáil colleagues in government are using about your party. So you say the government is very focused, but is Fine Gael a little more humble after the summer we've just had?
By the way, just the point I was making there, it is still a vote. No one wants to see any colleague in government leave. It's always regrettable. But I think we won't. I don't think you can just put it down to the motion of no confidence. I think really what Fine Gael is and what we've always been as a party is we're a party who respect the electorate. We're a party who respect the institutions of the state. We're a party who believe in doing the right thing and in public service. And I think those are the type of things that really exemplify what Fine Gael is all about. And we'll be staying focused on that. We'll be staying focused on the type of things, if we're leading into the budget, in making sure that we're getting people back to work, in tackling childcare issues, and also particularly in working with both Fianna Fáil and the Greens in tackling things like COP26 is coming up, which comes into my area.
These are really serious issues
that people really want us to focus on.
As your party leader, Leo Varadkar, reportedly said at a cabinet meeting last year, if you keep doing business like this, you won't be doing business for much longer, will you?
But we've recognised, and I think Minister Coveney, in the wonderful speech which he delivered last night, showed that humility and showed that understanding that we as a party and that our leaders have, that yes, of course we made mistakes during the summer and we did things in not the best possible way. But what you do, I think...
So are you a humble party that's learned that lesson?
I think what you do... It's not a case of being a humble party or a non-humble party. I think what the electorate want to see is a party that can now show that, as it has, by the way, for most of the last 10 years, that it's a good party of government and that can deliver for people on the issues they're really caring about this morning.
What about the allegation from Sinn Féin's Matt Carthy that Simon Harris was the minister who had leaked, who had been responsible for the cabinet leak about this appointment, a claim which has been, Simon Harris's spokesperson said was a clear abuse, misuse of Dáil privilege and untrue. Would it be better if the minister said so himself?
Well, I think it was a clear abuse of Dáil privilege. I think it's almost scary the way Sinn Féin acted last night in relation to this, because God forbid if they were to be in power, what type of abuses would they engage in?
Somebody at the cabinet table leaked the news of that appointment before the cabinet meeting was over.
We don't know that. I mean, this is a very interesting thing that you've just said there. You said somebody at the cabinet table. We don't know that.
Well, who else could have known the news?
We don't know who leaked it. We have no information on that. We have no name. So what we have
is important. I want you to clarify for me.
Yeah.
Because who other than the cabinet ministers could have leaked what was going on at a cabinet meeting before it was over?
But I don't know who leaked it.
Who could have?
I'm sure there are, if we needed to have an investigation to look at who could do that. But the point of the matter is this, and this is very important.
Could anyone other than a minister have been responsible for
that? My understanding is before I would get into that, I'd like to see if somebody would check out who has access to the information about when an appointment has been made like that. Because there is obviously other people apart from cabinet ministers that see information going into cabinet. But can I just say...
The names of appointments are kept confidential, aren't they, until it goes to the cabinet?
This is really important on this. We don't know it was a cabinet minister. We don't know.
What's your party leader doing to find out who it might have been?
The job of investigating a leak is actually something that falls to the Taoiseach. So if the Taoiseach wishes to set up a leak investigation, the Taoiseach can, and the Taoiseach is fully entitled to do that.
And given that this claim has now been made about Simon Harris, would it be useful if the Minister himself addressed it? Would it be useful if Leo Varadkar, as party leader, asked him the question?
Well, I have no doubt that Simon is going to be throughout the course of the day asked about this, but I just want to make one point because I think this is really important because it comes to the heart of the difference in the way that Sinn Féin behave, and Sinn Féin have real form on this, by the way. They've done this before. So they have a motion of no confidence, which maybe for them isn't attracting the level of attention they wanted out of it. So they come out with an allegation with no substance, no backup, no nothing. A deputy stands up under privilege in the Dáil, names somebody without any proof at all, not willing, by the way, yesterday to supply any indication that he had any proof, and he just throws out that name, and then that keeps the thing going for another day for Sinn Féin. I think that's an appalling way to do business. It's an abuse of Dáil privilege, and I would say that it shows something about the way Sinn Féin think about the way they can behave. They have a standard of behaviour in Northern Ireland. They have a standard of behaviour which they'd like to tell the people in the Dáil they carry out. But when it comes to the Dáil, they're quite happy to abuse privilege and do something like that.
Colin Brophy, Minister of State for Overseas Development and Diaspora. Thank you. 1 month after their takeover in Afghanistan, reports have emerged of fights between different factions of the Taliban, while the plight of the people there worsens daily. Channel 4 News International Editor Lindsay Hilsum is in Afghanistan, and she's been telling me about the power struggle that's dividing the Taliban.
Well, the Deputy Prime Minister, Baradar, he was one of those who was in the negotiations with the Americans, which were held in Doha over the last couple of years. So he is seen very much as a man who is favoured by Qatar. Qatar is really a key country here in Afghanistan. And the Haqqanis, well, they are regarded by the Americans and the British and the EU and the UN as a terror network, and they are really seen as the hard line. Yet several of their people are in very senior positions. Sirajuddin Haqqani, who has a $10 million bounty on his head from the Americans, he's the interior minister. His uncle, who I met the other day, is a minister for refugees, Khalil Haqqani. He has a $5 million bounty on his head. And they are seen as really the hardliners as opposed to the pragmatists led by Baradar. And at the moment, it does appear that the hardliners seem to be in the ascendant. But there's lots of arguments going on. And really the problem with this is as these people squabble, what about Afghanistan? Winning a war is one thing. Governing is quite another. The economy has ground to a halt. There's tremendous unemployment. There's drought. And people are heading towards a really terrible humanitarian disaster, according to the United Nations.
And for women in Afghanistan, 1 month after the Taliban have taken over, the situation appears to be getting worse by the day. You interviewed a former policewoman who's in hiding.
Yes, look, she is somebody, Fatima Ahmadi, who's in a very bleak position. She was already in trouble. She was one of those who Western countries encouraged to enter the security services. Now, women weren't normally in the security services in Afghanistan, but the West spent about $100 million on promoting women in the security services, saying that they should be there in the police and other forces. And she was one of those who took up that challenge. And she really enjoyed that job. Then she had problems. There was sexual harassment by her bosses, and she went public about that, which was a very brave thing to do. But the result of that was that her family then disowned her. She was already divorced because she'd been married, forced marriage at the age of 12. You see all the problems that women in Afghanistan had even before the Taliban. Now you have the Taliban, and she is living in hiding because the Taliban don't think that women should be in the police force. And also many of the criminals who these police women caught are now on the loose because the Taliban let them out of prison. So she is really destitute. And she is one of many women who are in a totally tragic and appalling situation. I was in Bamiyan yesterday, which is a Hazara area. The Hazara are a Shia group, and they never cover their faces. The women, they only cover their hair. They're really amongst those who have benefited most from the last 20 years of a more liberal regime. I was talking to a women's rights activist and a journalist, and they were, well, what are we going to do now? You know, the Taliban won't let us work. They won't let us go out. In fact, they haven't said that women can't work or go out. But what they have done is instill this terror into women. So some women are still going to work and others are just too terrified. And then another woman I know who was a member of parliament, 20 Taliban gunmen turned up at her office and demanded to see her. Well, she fled the country, and who can blame her?
And some, I suppose, small beacon of hope, the Afghanistan National Girls Women Football Team, those who made it across the border into Pakistan and managed to make it to freedom.
Yes. Look, every woman who makes it to freedom or every person who is under threat who makes it to freedom, that's an individual success. But everyone is a tragedy for this country. Because the entire middle class is trying to get out, as far as I can see. Anybody who has any competence in government is trying to get out. Now, the last government was very corrupt, but they did have technocrats and they did have people who, to some extent, knew how to run things. What you have with these mullahs now squabbling in the presidential palace about who gets the spoils, they have no competence at all. And so what is going to happen? How are they going to run a government? That's much more difficult than winning a war. And the result of their inability so far, and as far as I can see into the future, to actually run anything, the result of that is going to be tremendous hardship. The banks are still not fully open. People are only allowed to take out a certain amount of money a week. Many people are selling all their belongings because they have no means of income. The civil servants haven't been paid, certainly in the last month. And all the other parts of the economy, they're just juddering to a halt. And how you actually get that up and running, I don't think the Taliban and the ministers know how to do that. And those technocrats, who are the ones who would know how to do it, they've either fled or they're trying to flee.
Lindsay Hilsum, Channel 4 News International editor on those latest developments in Afghanistan.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with a Kia eSoul. Going electric? Stop wondering and start driving. The Kia eSoul with a range up to 452 kilometres.
And now with the time at 22 minutes to nine, Des Gals back with sports news.
Yeah, well, we're going to start with a night of great drama in the Champions League on you. Liverpool winning 3-2 at home to AC Milan in a game that went in their favour, went against them. They came back to win it. Liverpool taking an early lead through a known goal. And then Mo Salah missed a penalty as Liverpool were completely on top in the opening quarter. But Milan struck twice before halftime through Rebic and Diaz, and they led 2-1 at the break. Into the second half, and Mo Salah got an early equaliser, and the winner, a thunderbolt half volley from Jordan Henderson, making it 3-2. Here's the Liverpool manager, a delighted Jurgen Klopp.
Oh, we started incredibly well. We played a super game, a super, super, super intense game, but football-wise as well, really good. Played in all the space we had to play. Didn't give them anything until, I don't know exactly. We got punished for it in the last few minutes before halftime, but it started earlier. We got a bit carried away, actually, by our own football. Like, we didn't keep it simple anymore, offensively, and we were defensively not good organized anymore. You see, when we are organized, Fabinho is absolutely incredible and he can pick up all the challenges which we need him for. In a moment when the spaces are too big, even he cannot sort it anymore. Last line, slightly too deep. They found that way, played in between, scored two goals. Was not nice, but it didn't feel like we cannot come back in the second half. So it was clear we have to change. We have to immediately to get back to how we started, defensively especially. And then we scored wonderful goals, to be honest. Both were incredible and won the game, and I think it's deserved. But we had around about 10 minutes where Milan nearly changed the whole tie. Spectacular. Again, European night at Anfield, I love it.
The other game in that group, Atletico Madrid and Porto, drew nil all. In Group A, Manchester City were 6-3 winners over German side Leipzig, and the 6 goals obviously pleased Pep Guardiola, but he was frustrated with the 3 goals they conceded, especially as their next game in the group is at home against the French fancied side Paris Saint-Germain. Mind you, the French team were frustrated last night. They were held to a 1-1 draw by Bruges in Belgium. But Manchester City's newcomer Jack Grealish was buzzing after his first Champions League game.
Yeah, no, I loved it. Been waiting a while, and the past few weeks, I just couldn't wait for this game, obviously in particular. And it was a great night. I had absolutely everything. Obviously, in the end, we're obviously delighted to get the win. Obviously, against a good team as well. Full of energy, full of young players and stuff. So I'm delighted personally, to come away obviously mainly with the 3 points, but also a goal and an assist. Ball's just come to me, and when I'm in that position off the left hand side, running into the opposition area, I'd back myself, 1v1 against anyone to have a goal. So that's what I'd done, and luckily it paid off, and I managed to obviously hit the back of the net this time. I had a few in the first half that got blocked. I'm obviously delighted to get the goal.
I don't know, you've obviously watched the Champions League. It's not necessarily always quite like this 6-3 and everything that went on, but you've got PSG to play twice in this group. I mean, it's the big stage, and you're ready for it, aren't you?
Yeah, no, of course. I've just went inside there and checked the result from the other game, and it just shows, anything can happen in the Champions League. I think that's why it's such a wonderful competition. And I was obviously, delighted. As soon as the game kicked off, I just thought to myself, in my head, I've actually played in the Champions League now. And before with the music and everything, it was so nice. Obviously the game, it just topped it all off.
That's Jack Grealish. Now in Group C, Ajax were very impressive, 5-1 winners at Sporting Lisbon, and Dortmund won 2-1 at Besiktas. In Group D, Real Madrid scored a last-minute goal to snatch a 1-0 win at Inter Milan, while the Moldovan champions Sheriff, who've battled through 4 rounds of qualifying to get to the group stages, beat Shakhtar 2-0. Fulham went top of the English Championship. They had a 4-1 win at Birmingham, while the pressure on Nottingham Forest manager Chris Hughton has intensified. They lost 2-0 at home to Middlesbrough. In golf, Cork amateur James Sugrue has had 2 birdies in his first 3 holes this morning at the Dutch Open. He's just 1 shot behind the early leader, Martin Simonsen of Denmark. Meanwhile, the former winning US Ryder Cup captain Paul Azinger has questioned Brooks Koepka's desire for the competition next week. And Azinger said he thinks Koepka should give up his place in the squad for someone who would love to play if he doesn't want to. Koepka, in an in-depth interview with Golf Digest, said that he finds the Ryder Cup to be tough, hectic and a bit odd, and expressed frustration that he can't take naps during the week. Meanwhile, one of the most controversial figures in athletics, the distance running coach Alberto Salazar, has had his 4-year suspension upheld by the Court of Arbitration for Sport. In racing, after Gordon Elliott had his first winner yesterday on returning from suspension, with Fancy Foundations winning in Sligo in the hands of Brian Cooper, the good news is that Davy Russell is set to return to the saddle at Downpatrick tomorrow after 11 months out with a neck injury. And finally for now, Gavin, today's racing action is at Naas and it gets underway at 1:25.
The remains of Baby John, also known as one of the Kerry babies, were exhumed from his grave in Carras Éireann. It's been 37 years since his body, which has never been identified, was discovered on a South Kerry beach. No one has ever come forward to claim him. We've been looking at the science that has led to this exhumation, and our reporter Amy Ní Riada is here now to tell us more. Amy, there is little detail on the exhumation itself. What do you know so far?
Well, Gavin, we know that Baby John's remains were examined after they were found on White Strand Beach in Carras Éireann in 1984, but as you said, he remains unidentified 37 years later. He was only 5 days old, had 28 stab wounds and has been buried for almost 4 decades. I asked a forensic anthropologist, that's someone who studies human remains, about the level of evidence that can be salvaged after so much time. He said that if any preservation methods were used, what you would find 20 or 30 years later is something similar to a full body, but if those methods weren't used, then you were only examining bones, and from those bones an examination can determine age, gender, wounds. Of course, Gardaí already have that information, so that leaves the identification of the remains. I'll go into detail in that in just a moment, but first I also spoke to a consultant forensic archaeologist who was involved in the search and recovery of human remains, although she wasn't involved in this specific exhumation. Her name is Dr. Niamh McCullough. She's worked with the Independent Commission on the Location of Victims' Remains, on the Mother and Baby Home Commission investigation, and regularly works on missing person cases with An Garda Síochána. I first asked Dr. McCullough about the objectives of an exhumation.
In cases that are a number of decades old, speaking generally, I suppose principally, you're looking to locate the remains. That's your very first step. You can try and establish additional information about cause of death. In a case such as this, I would imagine principally the main achievement for this case will be the pursuit of identification.
Dr. Niamh McCullough there. Now, we have little detail from Gardaí on the reason why this exhumation was carried out, other than it being very necessary and very important. Samples taken from baby John at the time proved there was no link between himself and the wrongly accused Joanne Hayes, but Gardaí were not able to identify the remains. Of course, that was 37 years ago, and there have been significant advances in DNA profiling technology since then. Just last year, that new technology was used by Forensic Science Ireland to identify the remains of 9 people, as Dr. McCullough explains.
From the very first step of exhumation and the involvement of forensic archaeology and that step-by-step method, additional information can be garnered through to the role of the forensic anthropologist, who will provide additional information, again establishing cause of death, selecting the most suitable sample that you can use to proceed with identification through bone. And the single most important advancement in technology in this case is an improved method for extracting DNA from bone in recent years, and it has proved quite successful in many missing persons cases recently. So this is really one of the most significant advances in technology that has occurred in the last 37 years.
Hola, Amy, remind us of the appeal issued by Gardaí.
The Garda superintendent in charge of the review into the unsolved murder, Fleur Murphy, has again appealed to the mother of the baby to come forward. Gardaí still believe there are members of the public with information on the discovery of baby John in 1984 and are encouraging anyone who does to come forward.
Amy, thank you. That's our reporter, Amy Ní Riada. From tomorrow until January at the Crawford Gallery in Cork, people will have the rare opportunity to see some works of the 17th century Dutch artist Rembrandt van Rijn, 50 of his famous prints and some 200 of his etchings. Dr. Michael Waldron is with us. He's assistant curator at the Crawford Gallery in Cork. Dr. Waldron, good morning. Thanks for taking our call today.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be here.
What's in this exhibition and how did it come to Cork?
Well, I suppose Rembrandt in print presents 50 of the finest works from the Ashmolean Museum's world-class collection of etchings and dry points by the Dutch master Rembrandt van Rijn. The exhibition, I suppose, came to Cork because, I suppose, through a whole network of connections. But it is a touring exhibition that has been years in the making. And due to the pandemic, it has been delayed by 16 months. But we're so delighted that in partnership with the Ashmolean Museum, we've finally been able to bring it to Irish audiences. And this has really been made possible through our partners, KLM, Cork City Council, Irish Examiner, and of course RTE Supporting the Arts.
Yes, it's been a very long wait for you. What's special about this exhibition, and tell us about the significance of it, of the prints?
Well, I suppose the exhibition takes visitors on a journey through or back to the 1630s, 40s and 50s and explores various aspects of Rembrandt's printmaking practice. He was a master storyteller, and the images he creates are so captivating and unexpected. So they range from portraits and landscapes to nudes, religious scenes and scenes of daily life. They range in size as well, from half a postcard all the way up to, you know, A3. And they really are a delight. But I suppose, you know, this exhibition offers an unsurpassed opportunity to encounter nearly 400-year-old etchings and dry points by a really experimental artist who was a keen observer of life and of gestures and mannerisms in people. And this isn't an airbrushed kind of look at the world. It's really kind of warts and all. So they, you know, the works range from self-portraits, portraits of his family and friends, and then right through to, you know, kind of repugnant characters like the rat catcher.
Tell us about your own favourites.
Oh, I suppose, well, there are many favourites that have started popping up over the last few days while we've been installing. But I suppose among the my favourites would be, there's a self-portrait with his wife, Saskia, and he's really in the foreground and she's in the background. And it's kind of a study in, you know, depth of field. So he's darker in the foreground and she's a bit faded out. But he really looks like the actor Franco Nero, with these dazzling eyes kind of shaded with by the brim of his hat. I also love, there's a landscape called the Three Trees, and it's like just magnificent, dramatic scenery, really moody, and he really delights in making something that captivates us.
This is something that can't be replicated via Zoom, like many things over the last year and a half. You really have to be in the room with them. What do you hope people who visit will get from the exhibition?
Well, I suppose we're really inviting people to come in and come back as well, to make multiple visits. The exhibition is free entry and open daily, right the way through to the 9th of January, open late on Thursday evenings. And what we hope people will encounter is maybe an unexpected side of Rembrandt. You know, people know his paintings, perhaps the Night Watch, which is a monumental painting. But these are extraordinarily detailed works that kind of invite you in just into an intimate encounter. They're very, very special. And, you know, this is the last leg of this touring exhibition. So once it finishes, these works will then go back to sleep. They'll go back into storage for several years. So it'll be the last chance, really, to see them for many, many years to come.
And you can see an example on our Twitter account this morning. Dr. Michael Waldron, Assistant Curator at the Crawford Gallery in Cork.
Now, the Alliance Party is calling on President Higgins to reconsider his decision not to attend a centenary church service for Northern Ireland next month. Queen Elizabeth has been invited, which has been ordered, organised by Christian church leaders, and it will take place at the Church of Ireland Cathedral in Armagh on the 21st of next month. Alliance Party MP Stephen Farry is on the line. Good morning, Stephen Farry.
Good morning, Anya.
Your reaction?
Well, I think I certainly would ask the President to reconsider his decision. I know he's a very thoughtful and honourable person, and indeed he and his predecessors, in conjunction with the Queen, have really driven the process of reconciliation between Ireland and the UK over the past number of decades, with a whole series of very symbolic events, both in Dublin and in London. And indeed, we are trying to have an inclusive approach towards the decade of centenaries. I don't see this event as being a celebration of partition or a celebration of the creation of Northern Ireland. This is about marking the reality that Northern Ireland has existed for 100 years, but also then just facing up to all of the issues that are thrown up by that. Obviously, the partition and the creation of Northern Ireland, and also the southern state were very important milestones, but they're also part of a very traumatic time in our history. So there are a whole host of issues there that do need to be reflected upon, and the service is very much based upon those themes of reflection and hope. And it's not about celebrating Northern Ireland as such, or sort of like a co-creating type of exercise.
You want the President to reconsider then? What would you say to him?
Well, I think what is happening in Armagh is actually very much in keeping with the leadership he has personally provided himself during his time in office. And so I think there's a lack of clarity at this stage as to exactly what the reason why this is the case, that he has declined so far to attend. But I know this has been very many, many months in the making, and it's important to stress this is not part of the official Northern Ireland Office or UK government events around the centenary. This is very much the initiative of the four main churches, all of which, it's worth stressing, are organised on an all-island basis. And indeed, Archbishop Martin and his office are very much part of the organisation around this, and how the whole service is going to be framed.
But it's also, notwithstanding all of that, this division of the island is one of the, you know, it is the big fault line, isn't it, in Irish history and politics. And, yeah, you know, even today, these things, there's a lot of sensitivity around them. We don't know why the president wasn't able to accept this invitation. But it is a sensitive thing, isn't it? Do you appreciate that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the partition issue is a massive defining issue in terms of the history of our islands over the past 100 years and beyond. And it does bring up a whole host of issues. Some people will take a positive view in terms of the creation of Northern Ireland. Others will take a negative view. And indeed, what happened in Northern Ireland in the 1920s and in subsequent decades, in many respects, was very bad. And but this is about facing up to all of the issues. It's about recognising the positives in terms of some of the achievements of people from Northern Ireland, but also having those honest and frank conversations. Mm-hmm. In that regard, and those are the type of themes that the president in particular has been pushing, and that can be very much framed in terms of a church service. This is not a flag-waving exercise in any particular direction. It's about facing up to those difficulties and seeing how we can reflect on them and how we can take forward the process of reconciliation while respecting people's different opinions mm-hmm. on the constitutional question as we look ahead over the next number of years.
So you believe that Christian context, if you like, diminishes those sensitivities and makes it a cross-community event. Can I ask you a final question, Stephen?
Sure.
Sorry. In this centenary year for Northern Ireland, it's turned out to be a very uncertain year, hasn't it, from a unionist point of view, and an uncertain future?
Well indeed. I mean, the last few years have been very difficult, particularly as a consequence of Brexit. Which really has overturned a lot of the assumptions, particularly around the whole mix of relationships that have been encompassed in the Good Friday Agreement. So we are now in a very uncertain situation, and indeed unionism in particular, all the unionist parties are going through their own convulsions, and at present we have this threat from the DUP to potentially overturn the institutions and pull out from the executive. And that's just going to serve nothing whatsoever except to back them into a deeper corner and provide even more instability and uncertainty for people who need to access their health service and those who are trying to grow the economy. So we are certainly in very difficult times. And I think in that context, I mean, the heads of state coming together, even in a very symbolic way, could be something that actually sends a positive message and maybe refocuses minds.
Thank you for talking to us this morning. That's Alliance Party MP Stephen Farry.